From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week via Skype are VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuswara and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. Welcome, Patsy and Steve.
Happy to be here, Kim. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having both of us.
Well, here are the issues. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky gave an impassioned address to the U.S. Congress in a historic visit to Washington, where he also met with President Joe Biden. The Ukrainian president thanked America for its continued support in fighting Russia's invasion of his country and made a direct appeal for more aid. His visit came as Congress prepares to pass $45 billion in further military, economic, and humanitarian assistance related to Ukraine as Russia continues its winter offensive. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Belarus, his first trip to the country since 2019, raising fears in Ukraine that he intends to pressure Russia's fellow former Soviet ally to open a new invasion front against Ukraine. The committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol referred former President Donald Trump to the Department of Justice on four charges, including aiding the insurrection. Officials and global health experts are anxiously watching a COVID-19 surge there. China began to dismantle its zero COVID policy after unprecedented public protests. The Taliban have banned women from universities in Afghanistan, sparking international condemnation and despair among young people in the country. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Patsy, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky met with President Biden and also addressed the U.S. Congress. What are some takeaways from his visit?
So the first one was that it was a massive surprise to all of us. You know, we started hearing rumors of a Zelensky visit on Tuesday afternoon, but it wasn't until much later in the evening when the White House confirmed a senior administration official briefed us on the matter. And really, I think the visit is designed for at least two goals. The first one is to send a message to Russian Vladimir Putin that the U.S. is here to stay. It will support Ukraine for as long as it needs. And then the second one is really to help push along this giant massive spending package, $1.7 trillion in Congress, which includes $45 billion for Ukraine. And as you can see, this is something that Zelensky is very aware of when he spoke to members of Congress last night. And I just want to highlight two important points that I thought was really astute of Zelensky to say in his speech. Number one is that he clearly told the American lawmakers that your money is not charity. It is an investment in global security and democracy. This is, I think, Zelensky understanding very clearly that there are a small group of right-wing lawmakers who are close to former President Donald Trump who are questioning and who are saying that we are spending way too much money on Ukraine. This money needs to be looked at and so on. And the second thing that I think is important to highlight from his speech is when he said that there's no need to send American boots on the ground. Ukrainian soldiers are perfectly capable of operating American tanks and planes and other weapons. So these are two main concerns that Americans have, and Zelensky very astutely addressed them in his remarks, in his address to Congress, which received multiple standing ovation, if I may add. And so those, I think, are the major highlights of his visit to D.C.
By saying that about the Ukrainians can operate the U.S. tanks, the U.S. planes, he also signaled that Ukraine needs more. He plainly said it in several occasions at the White House during his news conference with Biden. He set it up on Capitol Hill that we need more. We will come back and ask for more. He's been talking about the Patriot missiles. He said one Patriot battery is a lot, and thank you for that. But we're going to come back, and we want more Patriot missile batteries. I felt that he did much more than any other foreign leader coming to the United States and not just asking for help, but the way he thanked the Americans. He said, thanks from our ordinary people to your ordinary people, Americans. The way he presented himself, he projects the aura of an everyman, an accidental politician who's on the front lines of what is the global battle between autocracy and democracy. And he played that up in many different ways. Just wearing fatigues instead of a business suit made that visual distinction about Zelensky's mission, that the war is consuming him right down to the clothes that he wears. And it gave him this sense of authenticity that he is unlike any other politician who's ever come to the United States, mainly because he's really not a politician. So the symbolism of Zelensky's visit was on display right from the time that he got out of the car.
And I think I would like to add on that note, he is somebody who is clearly, clearly an expert in public relations, in presentation. As we all know, he was in entertainment. He was a comedian before he was a president. And so when he was at the Oval Office and he gave President Biden this medal that he said was given by a Ukrainian captain, a hero that he had just met a day before in Bakhmut at the front lines. This belonged to this captain who operates the HIMARS system that was given by the U.S. And he said that this captain wanted to give the medal to, and I quote, a very brave president. And then he gave it to Biden. You know, these kinds of things matter a lot to the American press in terms of just, you know, adding color to our reporting. And so this is clearly something that Zelensky is a master in, I wouldn't say manipulating, but capitalizing on. And one more thing I'd like to add to Steve's points about the weapons is that, of course, Zelensky wants more and more and more. The Patriot system that the U.S. is sending, Russia is already calling it provocative. Zelensky wants more than just one Patriot missile system, which is a defense kind of system, because you can move it to one city and perhaps protect the infrastructure of a city, let's say Kyiv or Odessa, but it won't protect the entire country. It needs way more than just one Patriot battery to protect large swaths of the country. Biden was asked this question at the press conference. Why aren't you just sending everything that we want? He was asked by a Ukrainian journalist, which I thought was a really excellent question, because this is the first time that we've heard President Biden gave his explanation of why he is only sending weapons. I mean, it's already massive in terms of scale, but he's not going all the way. He is saying that basically we are sending Ukraine what it needs. And if we send more than what we are already sending, he said, and I quote, it would have the prospect of breaking up NATO and breaking up the European Union and the rest of the world. And we're just going to send Ukraine what it needs to be able to defend itself. The other thing that he said is that he really wants to make sure that all the European allies are on the same page on this thing and that they're not looking to go to war with Russia. So the issue of measured response and not escalating to the point of World War III is something that Biden conveyed in terms of weapon shipment to Ukraine yesterday.
And that conveyance also sends the signal that not all of Europe may be on the same page as the United States. There are countries among the NATO alliance that the United States and Poland and the Baltic nations who have been well out in front of understanding that the need to contain this and the need to stop Russia right here, right now, may not be the same sentiment that all the rest of the NATO leaders are concerned. So it says to me that there's this little dance that is being played about what weapons to send to Ukraine, when to send them, and how they're going to be used. Biden went out of his way to say that the Patriot missile system is a defensive system. It is used to shoot missiles out of the sky to protect the people on the ground around the Patriot missile battery. So these are just very deliberate cues that both Zelensky is sending and Biden is sending in order to keep the alliance together.
Russia's President Putin visited Belarus, raising fears that he intends to pressure Russia's fellow former Soviet ally to open a new invasion front against Ukraine. So what has been Belarus' response, and what would this alliance mean for Ukraine?
This is certainly something that the White House is watching very carefully. I mean, so far, we know that Belarus has been providing Russia with military support, with logistical support. There are questions, as well as not just Belarus, but also Iran. I mean, this is something that President Zelensky himself spoke about during his speech in terms of the transfer of Iranian drones. So this cooperation is something that the White House is certainly looking at. And the other piece of this is the fact that Vladimir Putin is doubling down. He is not considering at all any kind of discussion on peace talks. In fact, in that meeting that you're talking about, he said that Russia has nothing to be blamed for on the war. On the contrary, this war is the result of the policy of other countries, third countries, he said, which have always striven towards the disintegration of Russia. So he's certainly still thinking in the context of when the Cold War ended, the Warsaw Pact dissolved, obviously, but NATO kept on expanding east, and this is a direct result of that.
Okay, and let's move on to our next topic. Patsy, you've been reporting on the January 6th Select House Committee's release of its full report referring former President Donald Trump to the Department of Justice for criminal investigation and potential prosecution for trying to overturn the 2020 election. Well, some Democrats are saying to proceed with caution. So where does the White House stand on going forward with this?
They're standing very carefully and very cautiously, taking every possible precaution to not appear to politicize this process at all. Because as you would understand, it's a very easy narrative to look from outside and say, oh, this is Joe Biden trying to weaponize his Department of Justice if Attorney General Merrick Garland decides to take up the recommendation of the January 6th committee and investigate and prosecute former President Donald Trump. We don't know whether he will or not at this point. They're still taking things into consideration. But in the meantime, the White House is saying that we have nothing to do with this. This is all on the Department of Justice. They are an independent body. And in the American political system, it is to a certain extent. I mean, the Attorney General is appointed by the president, so he serves at the pleasure of the president with Senate confirmation. However, when it comes to things like this, there's a certain degree of independence that the Department of Justice has compared to other executive agencies. And this all stems from the history that in the 1970s, there was one president who did not care about that independence, and that was Richard Nixon, who tried to use his attorney general for political purposes during the Watergate scandal. So this is, you know, the norms and practices that was applied since that scandal that the White House, the Biden White House, is trying to honor and trying to underscore that this has nothing to do with us. We're not doing this because Donald Trump has just announced that he's going to be a candidate in 2024 and we want to eliminate him. So this is something that the White House is handling very, very carefully.
While this final meeting of the January 6th committee didn't have the kind of thunderbolts of new information or surprise witnesses like previous meetings, what it did is it showed its work. And it was a refresher about the series of hearings and the evidence that they accumulated and uncovered. There was a little bit more from one of the ex-president's closest advisors about her attempts to get Trump to call for calm. But the referrals for prosecution is something that has been debated and talked about for the last 6 months, 8 months, as to whether or not Congress was going to make these referrals. At the time when they started with the hearings, it seemed like the U.S. Justice Department was lagging behind and wasn't as up to speed on its investigation as the congressional investigation was. That said, it now seems that the Justice Department is as up to speed and has about as much information and testimony and investigative information that the Congress has developed. The Congress cannot prosecute the president. They had that chance when Trump was in office and they impeached him, but the Senate did not vote to remove him from office. What we're going to see and how we're going to see it is going to play out not necessarily in front of television cameras from Congress, but behind the scenes and in courts of law and in front of grand juries as the Department of Justice continues to figure out how it's going to prosecute its case and who it's going to charge.
And just to add this, I mean, Steve, you're a television producer. I just want to highlight the production value of the whole hearing.
It was awesome. As a television producer, it was fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, usually these congressional hearings are watched by a couple of hundred people, but this is 20 million people watched the January 6th hearings because exactly it was produced with the help of an executive television producer who knows exactly what to say, when, and how to present it, you know, with these flashy videos that really just keeps people watching and, you know, having like these little cliffhangers at the end of every hearing so that we want to know more about the next one.
And they did leave us with a little bit of a cliffhanger in that in the final report, in the paper report that's going to come out, there is, according to the executive summary, there's more in there about the attempts that Trump lawyers and the Trump side did to keep witnesses from testifying fully. And there may be some penalties for some of those lawyers down the road. But what it did highlight was the attempts that the ex-president and his minions, the lengths that they went to keep people who knew information from being fully truthful about that information.
Absolutely. And I just want to bring you back to like the large picture in case our viewers who may not be glued to American politics the way we are, Steve, I want to bring it back to your audience, Kim, of just the magnitude of this event. I mean, think about it. This is almost 2 years to the anniversary of the January 6th storming of the Capitol, okay? An insurrection attempt by supporters of Donald Trump. A committee of lawmakers, which included two Republicans, is saying to the Justice Department, prosecute this former president on multiple crimes related to his role in overturning the election that was won by the current occupant of the White House. And now that current occupant of the White House has to give it to the Department of Justice, who will decide what to do with all this information. And in the meantime, the American public, who's already polarized, has to finally settle on a narrative. This is the whole purpose of this exercises for us as a nation to settle on a narrative, a truth and reconciliation process, if you will, to understand what exactly happened 2 years ago and what was Donald Trump's role in it.
Very nice summary of that topic, but for the sake of time, we'll have to move on to our mid-break. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwar and VOA executive producer Steve Reddish. Well, leading scientists and the WHO are saying it may be too early to declare the global end of the COVID-19 pandemic because of a potentially devastating wave that's come into China. Projections have suggested the world's second largest economy could face more than 1 million deaths in 2023 after the abrupt change in course from their zero COVID policy. So what is reaction to this COVID surge in China?
Well, it seems that China's shift away from its zero COVID policy is causing as much upheaval and as much concern as the zero COVID policy did. People in China aren't getting much guidance from the top, which they're used to getting, and are puzzled about what to do. Hospitals are said to be filling rapidly. One hospital in Shanghai told staff to expect as many as half of the city's population of 25 million to be infected with COVID by the end of next week. So the opening of the COVID policy has many in the Chinese government hierarchy, from top officials through the censors all the way down to street police officials, they're not sure what to do. The biggest challenge China faces right now is getting people vaccinated, getting people who have been vaccinated boosted, especially the elderly.
So I asked this question to Dr. Ashish Jha, who is the White House coordinator for COVID, when they gave a press conference. I asked them whether the White House is making any contingency plans as China is relaxing its zero COVID policies, because, you know, as we know, there's going to be a lot of holiday travel, particularly with the Lunar New Year coming up. What are we doing in terms of trying to stop new variants or a potential outbreak? Because as we know, at this point, the U.S. is already seeing an increase of cases. Cases are up 90% across the country, and deaths and hospitalizations are also on the rise. And Dr. Ashish Jha is basically saying that the U.S. has this robust monitoring system for new variants, and they work together with various other countries to monitor these things, including through wastewater. This was something new that I learned, that this is how they monitor for new variants by testing wastewater routinely. And so I asked Dr. Jha if any of the contingency plans include a travel ban, and he sort of sidesteps that question and says that even if there are new variants, the U.S. is going to be ready to identify them. That's what he said. He said identify. He did not say ready to deal with them immediately. So this is something that the White House is watching. At the same time, they're also releasing what they're calling their winter preparedness program, which is, again, making free COVID tests available to all American households. We can now order them online. They'll send it to us for free, as well as doing a number of other things to make sure that, as Dr. Jha puts it, this winter does not look like the last winter or the winter before.
Well, in Afghanistan, the Taliban have banned women from universities, sparking international condemnation and despair among young people in the country. Girls have already been excluded from secondary schools since the Taliban returned last year. So what will the future be for these women and girls?
The short answer is that we don't know. The latest is that not only the students are told that they can't go to university, but right now, all women who work in the Afghan school system are being told to leave. I mean, right now it's a holidays there, but teachers, admin staff are still in. They're marking their exams and doing admin stuff, and they're being told that they can no longer come to work. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already released a statement saying that the U.S. condemns in the strongest terms this, what they call indefensible decision to ban women from universities, keep secondary school closed to girls, and continue to impose all these restrictions on the ability of women and girls to exercise their human rights and fundamental freedoms. So certainly this seems like it's a trend that's, instead of reversing, it's actually growing worse. At this point, we're already doing everything. You know, we're holding their funds. We're really not having that much diplomatic contact with them. So the question is, how much pressure can the U.S. and other allies due to change the situation on the ground in Afghanistan?
It's been one of the top concerns since the U.S. left Afghanistan is what will happen to the women of Afghanistan, the girls? Will they be educated? This backslide back to the past just follows what the Taliban government has been doing in recent months in moving back to applying Sharia Islamic law to criminal justice. It is a situation that is obviously concerning. Blinken, while he said that the Taliban can't be expected to be a legitimate member of the international community, he also said more consequences will be coming, but did not outline them, which kind of explains the United States and the rest of the world's dilemma, is that short of going back into Afghanistan, there really isn't much that the United States and the rest of the world can do to reverse this and allow women back into the classroom. It's a situation, as Patsy said, that the United States will be watching very carefully and doing what it can on the margins to make the situation better.
And we're going to go now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Patsy, what's been weighing on your mind this week?
Well, I'm just ready for the holidays, Kim. It's been a crazy, crazy, crazy year, everything that's going on. And, you know, this Zelensky trip was just a big surprise at the time when the White House was winding down. You know, we're seeing that briefings were not happening every day. And we're like, oh, now we can actually start our holiday planning and do my Christmas shopping. And then that happened. So I'm just looking forward for no more surprises this year and hoping for a better 2023 and wishing you both a happy new year and happy holidays.
Thank you. And Steve?
Yes, the holidays have been weighing on my mind, but something that happened during the Zelensky appearance at the White House, the news conference, when he called on a Ukrainian journalist who, instead of starting with a question, said to President Biden and the American people, "Thank you for helping my country." And it really struck me that a journalist would say something like that. American journalism, we're supposed to be dispassionate observers of what is happening and not put ourselves into the story. And here, this journalist, from his heart, thanked the President of the United States, thanked the American people for their help for his country. And I was just putting myself in his shoes and wondering whether or not, as a journalist, I could do that. It just made it really hit home for me what is going on, not just in Ukraine, But for journalists around the world who are seeing what is happening inside their countries and what they can do other than reporting the news to help the situation within their countries. For the holidays, I hope and wish everyone for peace and tranquility and certainly a better 2023.
And we'll end the show on those thoughts. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Kuzwara and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.